You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Meg Waite Clayton is the author of The Postmistress of Paris, The Wednesday Sisters, and The Last Train to London. Her new novel is Typewriter Beach. Thank you for joining me, Meg.
Rick, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
You know, this is a wonderful novel in so many ways, and I wanted to talk to you about them. First and foremost are the two sets of characters you create, and it takes place in two different time periods. Talk about creating the characters and the time periods. Which characters and time period came first?
Yeah, well, so as you say, the characters, the story is set in 1957 and 2018, Carmel by the Sea in Hollywood, and it tells the story of an unlikely friendship between an Oscar-nominated screenwriter and a young actress hoping to be Alfred Hitchcock's new star. And then the parallel story in 2018 is Leo, the screenwriter's granddaughter, comes to clean out his cottage after he's passed away in 2018. So those are the two parallel stories. The story for me started with the 1957 story when I set off to write it. I was going to write a story about the blacklist. That's what pulled me into the story, about a blacklisted screenwriter. I will tell you that when I sat down to write it, I'd been working on another novel that my editor had already offered me a bunch of money to write. I had said I would write it, but I had declined the money at the time for a variety of reasons, most importantly because I don't do my best writing when I write under contract. I do my best writing when I just, you know, rip open my heart and see what's in there. So I was working on that novel and two things happened. One, my dad passed away, and two, the pandemic, not in that order. First, the pandemic and then my dad passing away. And I found myself for the first time not able to write. And I had put together a little Zoom writing group with some friends, just three friends who wouldn't have called themselves writers. And this was my effort to get them to call themselves writers because they all write beautifully. And I told them one Friday morning that I was going to set aside that novel and try to write this blacklist novel. So I'm setting out to write a blacklist novel. We turn off our Zoom cameras and our Zoom microphones and we set off to write. And what comes to my page is a blacklisted screenwriter whose name is Leo, which happens to be my dad's middle name, and his granddaughter Gemma, which happens to be very close to my name backwards. And what poured out of me then was the grief at losing my dad, in the form of this relationship with Leo, who loves Gemma the way my dad always loved me and allows Gemma to believe in herself the way that my dad always allowed me to believe in myself. And so it started, even though it was going to be a 1957 story, it started with the 2018 story. I thought that would just be my way into the story and I would eventually throw that writing in the garbage can. But then what happened was I discovered as I started writing the 1957 story that Gemma and Leo are both people who keep secrets, and they would not tell them, and nor would they tell each other secrets. And so I needed somebody to uncover their secrets, and so Gemma ended up staying in the story and being the parallel 2018 story. That also allowed me to explore Hollywood then and now, especially as it relates to women, which was very interesting for me as well.
Had they told you their secrets?
I had to pry them out of them.
Well, that's one of the things I think that's really interesting about this book is I read a lot of horror novels, you know, and various things along those lines. And in those novels, the idea of plot is always somebody going somewhere and doing something, and it usually involves a gun, a knife, or a chase somewhere, you know, detectives, cops, the government, whatever. And so plot to me is kind of like, when you say plot, I think falling over a waterfall, not... But this book has a really page-turning, intense plot, which revolves around people talking to one another and getting to know one another and making decisions about the character of the person they're with. And I thought that was really beautifully handled, really compelling, and it stood out to me as a means of plotting. And I thought, wow, what a great writer. Thank you for doing that. So talk about plotting with character and character revelation.
Oh, that's a good question. First of all, thank you. No writer minds having their work praised, do they? I am not a thriller writer. I am not a I am primarily a, you know, kind of a mainstream fiction writer, a literary fiction writer. My plots are very character driven, but I find that what drives plot often is basically the reader wanting to know something. You know, the reader on the edge of their seat about knowing something, and so that can be whether, you know, somebody's going to survive this chase scene or whatever, or it can be just learning about a character, learning what's going to happen. I mean, there's certainly plot in the more traditional sense in the story. I mean, the opening of the book, Isabella goes to audition with Hitchcock. So, you know, from the get-go, the question is Isabella ever going to get to be the movie star she wants to be? Leo is blacklisted, and so there is the through line of is Leo ever going to be able to unburden himself from the burdens of the blacklist? Is that ever going to end? I mean, that was a long time in American history, and I'm sure that Leo's based on a lot of research on the real characters, and I'm sure they live day to day wondering if tomorrow would be the day when it ended. So,
you know, I love that opening with Hitchcock. I'm here in Rio del Mar, which back in the 50s, there was an incident where the seagulls had eaten some fish from a red tide and became very aggressive down here. And that inspired Hitchcock, who at the time lived in Scotts Valley, to write, you know, his most terrifying to me story, The Birds. But so I really like the way that you mixed in real characters and the characters you clearly created. Talk about that. Was that intimidating to you in any way to write about Hitchcock, who himself was so famous and so picky? He said, when the script's done, the movie's done.
Yeah. Hitchcock isn't the first real character that I've put on the page. My sixth novel, Beautiful Exiles, was about the kind of stormy love affair between the journalist Martha Gellhorn and her first husband, Ernest Hemingway. It was daunting doing Hemingway and Gellhorn, for sure, especially because they were the center of that story. This Hitchcock certainly plays a role, but he is what I would call an ancillary. He would be, you know, best supporting actor, not best actor. That having been said, he's Hitchcock, right? And everybody knows Hitchcock, and he's such a character that it was slightly daunting to try to put him on the page. So what I did was, I mean, I've been watching Hitchcock movies my entire life. My mom and I, you know, we were so different, but the one thing we shared was Hitchcock movies. So I was steeped in who he was, and I had read a lot about him, but I hadn't done a deep dive into researching who he was. And so that's what I did for this book. It was very fun. I read the Hitchcock, the Truffaut interviews with Hitchcock, conversations, I can, which they're called, but which were really very revealing. And it's one French director talking to his iconic American director, and then the French director went on to be iconic, obviously. I read biographies of him. I found everything I could find about him. You know, for example, one of the things that happens in the course of the novel is that there is a scene in that house you're just referring to, Hitchcock's house in Scotts Valley. And so I thought, oh, well, I'll just go up there and see what it looks like. And so I drive up there and I get to, you know, the end of this road that is obviously, you know, it's the drive to Hitchcock's, and it's a long drive, so you can't see it. It's kind of like I've described it in the book. And there's a sign there at the very beginning, you know, basically, do not enter or we will shoot you. It's no longer Hitchcock's. And I'm sure whoever, you know, owns it now is very tired of people, you know, coming up and wanting to see Hitchcock's home. But so you can find, you know, you can find all sorts of things. And so I found an article in It might have been in the Santa Cruz paper about Hitchcock's home. And it told me a lot of the details about it so that I could imagine it. And then a lot of things I learned about Hitchcock just from reading about him. I watched, you know, obviously I watched Hitchcock movies and Hitchcock Presents, you know, the TV series in the afternoon and called that work. So that was a real nice benefit of, you know, putting Hitchcock in it. But so what I do is I do that deep dive. I try to steep myself in the character and then the real person. And then I set it aside because obviously they have to interact with my pretend characters, right? My fictional characters. And so I try to craft a scene that is true to the character, but allows them to interact with my fictional character. And so for that, for example, that first scene, let's just say that for anybody who hasn't read, there are steaks involved. And I will say that Hitchcock liked steak for lunch, and he didn't like a steak for lunch. He liked steaks for lunch. He would eat several of them. And so that sort of was part of the inspiration for that scene.
You know, I really loved the character Leon Chazan, and I couldn't help but think of, I guess, his actual opposite in a way, Elias Kazan, director well known for naming names and yes. staying off the blacklist and being, you know, he was the guy who brought us Bonnie and Clyde. That was a pretty big deal. When I was a kid. And so talk about creating this character. And I love that, you know, the historical nature of this book is really interesting because where I am old enough to not necessarily think that 2018 is a historical epic, even though it is to many people now. To me,
me too. You know, that's like yesterday, right? That is not history.
Exactly. But, you know, one of the things that really comes out in this novel is the idea, you know, on one hand, you'll have people who say, you know, those who don't learn history are doomed to repeat it. On the other hand, you'll have people who say history never repeats, it echoes and rhymes, but doesn't repeat. I think we have both factions operating in your novel because so many of the things that were happening in 1957, we are a half a step away from HUAC right now. I mean, it would be the DEI Act or something, but talk about creating, you know, the politics and how, but I like how the politics are reflected in the character, not the other way around. You learn the politics from the characters.
Yeah. Well, I will say, for starters, that, you know, the way publishing books work, this book was done before, let's just say, before the last election cycle. And I had no sense that it was going to be as timely as it is, let's say. I do think one of the things I think is important about a historical fiction is it allows you to feel what it's like. I mean, when we learn history in class, and you know, as a history major in college, it's kind of from above, and you see, you know, you can see where the troops moved, and you can, but you don't necessarily see what it was like to live in, you know, occupied Paris, or what it's like to live as a blacklisted screenwriter. And so, I feel like one of the benefits of historical fiction is to allow us to inhabit those people's shoes and feel the history, as opposed to just experiencing the history. So when I'm writing historical fiction, I try to stay very close to the real history. I want, when the reader walks away from my book, they're going to feel like they've learned something about this history, and I want what they learned to be the real history. So that was really important to me as I was crafting Leo in particular. And so I, you know, what I did to create him is I read everything I could to find out about the blacklisted, who the blacklisted writers were. I watched, you know, movies like Roman Holiday with Audrey Hepburn and Cary Grant, which was one of the blacklist, you know, a movie that was written by a black, you know, Dalton Trumbo, one of the most famous blacklisted screenwriters. And and then there's a great collection, I'm going to draw a blank on what it's called, but there's a great collection of interviews with people who were blacklisted. That is just very personal interviews. And the people there talk about things like the fact that their children at school lost all their friends because when they were blacklisted, you know, the whole family, it wasn't just the person who was blacklisted who became toxic, you know, for people's futures, the whole families became toxic. And so it just was quite devastating to read about. I think it's important to understand that. I think if you raise people's sympathy and empathy for people going through things like that, maybe they bring that into today and think twice about whatever is happening today. This certainly was meant to be a cautionary tale. It wasn't meant to be quite as relevantly immediately cautionary, or perhaps too late cautionary as it turned out to be. But yeah.
One of the things I loved about Leo was what a gentleman he was. And what you just get the feeling that he's a really, truly nice guy. And I like the hell, love the hell out of this character. And that's, I think, a brave decision to make a guy who's, like, really pretty much a good guy through and through. But, you know, he doesn't have to dress up in underwear and fly.
He could, you know, he'd be happy to do that. He could write the dress up in underwear and fly. So part of what I'm working with there is the idea that, I mean, the way people were blacklisted was, you know, they were painted as really bad guys. They were painted as communists, and all communists were Stalinists, and all of them wanted to take down America, and therefore they had to be eradicated. You know, in fairness, in the 1950s, you know, the Russians had just gotten the bomb, and China was going communist, and there was a great fear, and, you know, at some point in time, Sputnik was going overhead, right? And so there was a great amount of fear in American society. But what happened with the blacklist and with HUAC is, and especially with McCarthy, is people with political ambitions preyed on those fears for their own political gain. And I felt that it was important to have Leo be somebody who was very lovable, because the knee-jerk reaction would be for people, you know, you say communist, and I think sometimes the knee-jerk reaction is to not like that person. He's not technically a communist, but, you know, nor were a lot of the people who were blacklisted. It was enough that you were progressive, which many of us could be, you know, guilty of these days. And so I did that. But I will tell you, the other part of that is that Leo is, at his heart, he's my dad. He's just, my dad was this incredibly warm, generous, kind person. He wasn't perfect. You know, Leo's not exactly perfect, but he loves in a way that makes us, I think, love him back. I have yet to meet anybody who doesn't love Leo, starting with my editor, who said she's heard that my favorite character, her favorite of all the characters I've ever written. So, yeah.
Congratulations. I love that he was inspired by your father. It really brings, a close personal note in this novel, which I think feels very close and personal. And one of the things, too, I loved was how you are willing to take, you know, the big swing and reach deeply into history, into, you know, one of the most critical times, which we are, other than right now, when Germany was being taken over, essentially from within, by Hitler, who was using the tools of democracy to dismantle democracy. And that's, that was somewhat unexpected to find that, and really a pleasure to read. And I thought you did a great job of using that to help create, you know, to talk about, you know, I guess, writing a historical novel that operates at different levels of history with equal effectiveness.
Oh, well, thank you. The reason Leo's backstory is his backstory is largely because, historically, that was very true. Many of the writers, many of the writers in Hollywood were refugees from Hitler's Europe. Writers who came to the, fled the United States, escaped the United States, and they needed to make money. And Hollywood was a place where they could make money. It was not, you know, it was not the swankiest job at the time. It was a place you could go to make money, but it was kind of considered, you know, a little suspect, you know. And so people came to Hollywood and made money. There's a real character that I use very sparingly in the novel whose name is Sonia Vertel, and she was exactly that kind of character. And she kind of set up this little pipeline of, you know, she had a home where she would welcome refugees into her home and bring help people get out to Hollywood and stuff. And so she was very instrumental in that. But so that's, you know, that's the real history. I don't have to make that up. Those are, and then those people, because they had been often in the resistance in France, for example, they had, if they weren't communist, I mean, the resistance, this is one of the things that people don't always know, that the resistance in Paris was largely communist. I mean, there was the communist who opposed Hitler and you know, did all the things that eventually helped us to liberate France. So a lot of them obviously got into trouble and had to escape so that they wouldn't be hung. And so that's very true to the history of the blacklist. They came to, they, you know, come to Hollywood with these communist roots, and after the war's over, everybody's, you know, looking around for a scapegoat for why the Russians got the bomb or whatever, and that's, you know, they turn to those people. So that was very true to history. Yeah.
Lest we don't want to forget Izzy, who is a wonderful character also. That's, I think, one of the things that makes this book work is the way the chemistry between the characters, and also Gemma and Sam in the current day setting. So talk about Izzy, and I think one of the things that was really nice about this was that we see the kind of reflection of HUAC and what's happening today culturally, and also the same thing with the way women were treated in Hollywood in the 50s, worse than today. And today, with the Me Too, it's a great example of history echoing but not repeating. And of course, rhyming is the right term. History has an unfortunate habit of rhyming and not always in the best fashion.
Yeah, that's actually a really great quote. I love that. You're going to have to, you know, send me whoever said that. But that is certainly what happens in the, you know, in the story. The story is obviously about the blacklist, but it's also about women in Hollywood and the particular challenges they face. And so, you know, it really literally starts with Isabella, and the first line is her hair. That was the first thing they changed, even before they changed her name, you know, before her first screen test, before Hedda Hopper wrote that bit in her gossip column about Isabella being 16 and innocent and yet somehow elegant. It explores things like, you know, the fact that the studio contracts generally had a clause that they could require an actress, or an actor for that matter, but the actresses more often were subject to it, to have a plastic surgery if they needed it. So even actors like Elizabeth Taylor, after she was famous, I mean, she was a child star and she was very famous at like age 11 or something. And then as she matured, her nose broadened and they didn't like that. And so they had her nose job to narrow her nose after she was already a star. So I don't know, you know, if you're already a star and you need to look different, then I don't know. But and so that is actually definitely a rhyming. There are many ways that women are treated better in Hollywood now. Obviously, there are women directors now. There have always been women writers, but in kind of bigger numbers now. And women are, many women are starting to take power in Hollywood, let's just say, which is a great thing. Nonetheless, if you look at the numbers, there are still so many fewer women directors than male directors. There are so many fewer women writers than male writers. And this year was actually the first time since they've been, you know, counting, where there were as many female protagonists as male protagonists in the top 100 films in terms of gross for the year. So that's progress. But still, the women we see on screen are largely shaped by men behind the screen. And my feeling is that really affects what we see as women is appropriate for women on screen, what women can be, what they can do, how they can behave. And that shapes our whole society because film has such an outsized influence on what we think of for women. So we have a ways to go. We've made progress. We have a ways to go. Absolutely.
You know, that was another interesting point, is the fear of how Hollywood has this great influence. It seems like that's certainly a case of history rhyming, but also, too, it's an interesting case because every generation has, you know, this new technology is going to ruin. Comic books are going to destroy society. That's what I was when I was a kid. And then, you know, here I am, a parent, I'm thinking, video games are going to destroy society. And I think, oh, no, they're just comic books. Oh, no, I become a dad. Oh, what am I going to do?
Exactly.
Through all this, though, Hollywood has had an evil grip on society.
I don't know if it's evil, but it certainly has a grip, you know, and there have been so many iterations where, you know, film was going to, it was going to be the end of film, you know, when TV started in the 50s, you know, it was going to be the end of film because it was something people could watch at home. They didn't have to pay for it. They didn't have to go and get out of their easy chairs and people still, you know, went to the movies. Now we have obviously video games. So they're, I think, the biggest grossing entertainment now, outstripping books and movies and everything else. Nonetheless, people, you know, we're finding different ways of seeing movies. I mean, you stream, you don't even have to go to the theater. You can stream them whenever you want. There's all that advantage. And I still think when people think of kind of the iconic things that shape our society, it's probably largely film. It's probably because, you know, you get a great character in film, and it's hard to sustain a great character over a TV series. And obviously video games, there's some character there, but character is, I don't think, for the most part, central to video games. So the, you know, the Hannibal Lecters of the world, let's say, or Superman for that matter, you know, they are big in film, in a heroic in film in a way that I think it's hard to sustain in any other medium.
Well, I remember back in 1982, I think, after Ridley Scott had directed Alien and Blade Runner, both movies that were, Alien was maybe more of a hit, but Blade Runner was definitely a flop. He said, the novel is dead. I think history has already decided on that one. One of the things that I really liked about this book was, you know, the Carmel setting was wonderful. And I think, you know, that you unearth a really wonderful history about Roberts and Jeffries and the Tor House. And, you know, it's just a shame that Hitchcock never made your movie.
It is a shame. Maybe he'll come back from the grave. Maybe the next Hitchcock, whoever that is, will make the movie. You know, Tor House and Hawk Tower, I think many people who have been to Carmel, I mean, obviously Carmel is this very charming town with these storybook cottages and a beautiful, beautiful oceanfront walk. And but one of the things that people often miss, and I often ask this in live events, you know, how many people have been to Carmel? Almost everybody. How many people have ever been to Hawk Tower and Tor House in Carmel? And almost nobody. It's a little out of the way. It's out on the point. But it is this very... The poet Robinson Jeffers built a Tor House with some stonemasons, and he learned how to build with stone from that. And then he made Hawk Tower on his own. And you can tell when you look at them that Tor House is made by people who are very good stone makers, and Hawk Tower is made in some other way. But Tor House is charming and lovely. Hawk Tower is really, really evocative. It's you know, it's this tower that's kind of this gnarly stone, and it's but you know, when you go inside it, it's like it's got a secret stairway. And one of the things I didn't know who Robinson Jeffers was when I started the book. What I knew is I had walked by that Hawk House and Tor, uh, Hawk Tower and Tor House, and I wanted to do something with Hawk Tower. So I took Leo and I put him in a little cottage just right across the road on the non-ocean side view, you know, the non-ocean view side of Hawk Tower, because obviously he's a blacklisted screenwriter, he wouldn't have that much money, started exploring Robinson Jeffers. And as so often happens, I mean, one, he's just an extraordinary poet. He's a he's an environmental poet, really, and he was as famous in the 30s as Robert Frost. I mean, he was one of the most America's most popular poets, and then he ended up opposing the war and losing his popularity as a result of that opposition to the war. But this tower he built for his wife so she would have a way to get away from the kids. So it's just got a great story behind it, and it's a lovely thing to thread through the book.
Reading about Jeffers, I just thought, wow, this guy's I knew a little bit about him, but reading about him in your book, what I thought is, this guy is as good in real life. He almost seems like somebody you would have to make up, who had been made up, because he's so eccentric and such a perfect character to, you know, reach the height of fame and then just drive himself into obscurity while building this giant tower for his wife that, you know, no woman or in her right mind would really want to spend much time in, because it's like something out of a horror movie.
It is sort of out of a horror movie. And yet I think she did spend a lot of time. You know, what's interesting is it looks like it's sort of out of a horror movie. And when you go inside, there's things like, you know, there's like when you walk inside, there's literally a hawk that, you know, I think he's stuffed, hawk that kind of looms over you in the entrance and can be a little startling when you first walk in if you're not expecting it. There are certainly, you know, hawks that hang around the tower. I mean, we definitely have hawks in Carmel. I definitely used it in a kind of a Hitchcockian way. I mean, that was very intentional because it sort of, in many ways, is a dark shadow over Leo's life as Leo lives across the street from it. Robinson Jeffers' story of great fame and failure, you know, is very parallel to Leo's story of great fame and failure. And I didn't have to make it up. I just found that. I just started reading about Robinson Jeffers, and there it was. I'm like, oh, this is perfect. I'll take this. Let me put this in here. And so that was a real, real blessing, along with getting to read some fabulous poetry. So, yeah.
What was nice was that the current day characters were equally compelling and interesting. I loved Sam's story. You know, the video game success is really, it's fascinating and feels true. I've talked to a few writer for video games in my unstoried career, and the feel that you have for this setting for Sam and also for Gemma, her story is great. There's a scene in there where she's meeting with a producer and they go through this thing she does really well, and then the producer just does something that is unfortunately all too believable. So, talk about, you know, when you're so immersed in the historical aspects, going back to World War II, 1930s, that's, you know, 100 years ago, say, talk about making your current day characters equally compelling.
Yeah, that is, in some ways, was the biggest challenge for me, because although I wrote some more contemporary stories early in my career, for the last four or five books that I've been writing historical, and so to you know, drag myself back into more or less the present was a bit of a challenge. I really loved, I mean, one of the things was I wanted to be able to deliver Carmel today as well as Hollywood today, and in order to do that I obviously had to have some pretty contemporary characters, and as I said, I was very interested in Hollywood then versus Hollywood now, and so, you know, Gemma is my character to do that. I know a lot of screenwriters. I Had the privilege of coming into the working world at a time when I was actually a lawyer when I started, and I was often the only lawyer in the room, I'm the only woman in the room. And so I'm very familiar with that struggle for women to find a place in what's historically been a man's world. And so since, you know, Hollywood is still pretty male, it wasn't that hard to imagine Gemma making her way in that world. What was a little harder to imagine was, what somebody's Gemma, who's Gemma's age, what she's like, you know. But my kids are not that different in age. I have two sons. They're not that different. Neither of them write screenplays. One's an economist. One does artificial intelligence. He would call it machine learning, but everybody else knows it is artificial intelligence. But he's one of the good guys. Don't worry. but they also are great video gamers. And so, you know, one of the things I did for Sam was I had them, you know, show me how to play video games, which I had never done before. And I read a series of essays on different ways that people have developed video game, video games, some pretty famous ones, and it strikes me that it is this very similar creative process to any other kind of writing, where you are making up characters, you're making up things that happen, and you're just delivering them in a different medium. So once I realized that, then I thought, I'm writing novels. Maybe I should be writing video games because they make a lot more money.
One of the things I loved is the character arcs of the book and the way they crisscross. Were you working, did you write the novel in a sense in two different, completely different stories and then interleave them? Or did you interleave them as you wrote them and create the crisscrossings in that manner?
You know, that's a very good question, and I'm not sure that I could even give you an honest answer. The way that I write is a little different than a lot of people. What I do is I start any way I can, just put words on the page. You know, sometimes I'll just put the word "the" there in my journal and hope some kind word will join it and start making a sentence. Fade in, exactly. It's so, right? And so that's one of the beauties of a screenplay is you write two words, fade in, and then you're writing. And that's very, you know, that was when I realized that. I thought, oh, I'm going to be a screenwriter. You know? I just start. I just write whatever comes for a few chapters. I see who shows up to this current little party I'm working on. And then when I have enough to have an idea of who the characters are and maybe what the story will be, I set the chapters aside. I take some of those, this will show my age, but those 3x5 note cards that I used to write term papers with, or at least that I was supposed to write term papers with when I was a kid. And I take a stack of them. I just write down ideas for things that might happen in the story. Just write down an idea, throw it on the floor. Write down an idea, throw it on the floor. And what that does for me is it turns off the editor on my shoulder. Because, you know, if I'd had an idea for, you know, Rear Window or Jaws or Name Your Other Favorite Movie, at some point in time I would have thought that was a terrible idea and I would have thrown it in the garbage can. So, you know, what that does is it allows me to get all the ideas down before I start judging them. And then I pick them up and I spread them out on the floor and I move them around and I almost always have, you know, I already have the beginning or something like the beginning because I've already started writing. I have a few chapters. I have, you know, a couple of key scenes, maybe 3, 4, 5 big scenes that could be in the middle. And then I usually have a sense of an ending for the book. And then I put them in some kind of order and I tack them up on a magnetic wall in my office. And then I start writing a screenplay. Because the thing about a screenplay is, one, you got that fade in, right? But I've already got some words on the page, so that's not so important. But also, it allows me to get the action and the dialogue of the scenes without having to do a huge amount of research or get bogged down in the details of, you know, for example, on The Last Train to London, there were scenes set in the late 1930s in the train station in Vienna. And to write the whole scene, I would have to do all the research to see what the train station in Vienna was like at the time. But for a screenplay, I can just do, you know, a slug line, Vienna train station day, you know, and then just start writing. And so it allows me to get a sense of the structure of the novel before I have the whole novel. I think that when I did that with this story, I focused on the 1957 story. I haven't actually gone back to that screenplay since I started writing the novel, but I expect if I went back and looked at it, what I would have primarily is 1957 scenes. I'm not sure that I'm not really a screenwriter. I'm not sure that I know how to write a dual timeline screenplay yet. But then as I was writing, then I wrote the two stories at the same time, and I would put those, you know, I put those cards up on the wall, and I, you know, I don't always write sequentially. I often do, but sometimes I get stuck, and so I just find a scene that I feel like writing, and I pull that card down off the wall, and I write the scene from it. And then one of the things I do is, when, because there are multiple points of view, when I've written the scene, I replace the white card with a colored card that is the person who carried the scene, the point of view that carried the scene. So I have, you know, when I'm done, I have pretty colors up on my wall as well as the cards. And the other thing it does, that card outline does for me, is it allows me to, I mean, I have to, for those cards, I have to describe in just a few words what happens in that scene. And if I can't describe what happens in that scene in just a few words, probably nothing really happens. And maybe whatever I think I'm trying to do in that scene can be tucked into another scene so that I get, you know, more pace in the story, so the story doesn't bog down with slow scenes. So
this is like outlining without outlining.
You know, I think of my screenplay as an outline, and then that card, you know, my card on the wall, I actually call it my card outline, because it is very much an outline. It goes chapter by chapter, sometimes scene by scene, but mostly chapter by chapter. Sometimes I'll have a chapter that'll have three points of view in it, and you'll see three colored cards taped together, you know, so that they all, you know, hang together. So
I may be showing off my age here, but as I read this book, a character who's based on a real character, his name is Mannix, popped up. And I love that character, even though he's a total SOB. And it was so interesting because I read your book and I'm reading it and you describe him. And I thought, I wonder if this has something to do with an old TV series I used to watch called Mannix. Because that guy, I was thinking, that is the most humorless detective ever to have multiple seasons or shows. And then I looked up and saw the real character, and thought, boy, she nailed that guy.
Yeah. So Eddie Mannix in the story is based on a real character. He was a Hollywood fixer, basically. I mean, it was something that really had. And so, you know, if Judy Garland was on a bender, you know, the studio's fixer would go and rescue her and take her to dry out or whatever. If, you know, Tab Hunter was, who was gay at a time when male stars could not be known to be gay and still be stars, you know, he would get Tab from a party and, you know, pay off or get in one way or another, get everybody to be quiet so that, you know, so that Tab Hunter's sexuality didn't go public. And so that's who Eddie Mannix is. He's a real, you know, he's based on a real guy. And he was really interesting to learn about. And I'll tell you that there's one scene that's not, it's a scene that happens in actually the 1930s, and it's when Isabella is basically telling us who Eddie Mannix is. And I put that in because that is real. That is something that really happened. And I wanted people to understand that that's, you know, it says a lot about the plight of women in Hollywood and the way somebody like Eddie Mannix would operate. So
Isabella is such a great character, and it's so wonderful when she ends up here in the 21st century getting a part as the wise grandmother. Talk about creating, you know, and her character arc contains both ends of the rainbow. Neither of them could really, you know, when you're young, you're a pawn and you know, they'll do a nose job on you and at the drop of a cane. On the other hand, by the time you get to have accumulated wisdom, accumulated beauty within and knowledge and just be, you know, a thoroughly wonderful person who can act the heck out of everything, you know, the parts that you can have are like microscopically controlled.
It's really interesting. I mean, and you, in comparison to men who, you would have take your favorite male star, and you know, when he's 60, Sean Connery, for example, you know, he's playing, you know, his love interest is an actress who's 26. So there's, you know, men in Hollywood have long lives, and as you know, romantic heroes, and women do not. You know, women after 40 start having a really hard time, you know, getting leading roles in Hollywood. And so Isabella is definitely meant to reflect that. She turns it on its head a little bit. You know, she's the only role she gets is a grandmother at the end, but she makes something of that shows her spunk and her sassiness and her willingness to break out of who she has always been expected to be, and be a little bit more who she is as well. So she was a really fun a character to write. She is, I would say, not as universally likable as Leo, let's say. I think people have different views of her, and I think it's very interesting to watch because part of the reason they do is because she's female. And I think if Isabella were male and doing the things that she does in the story, people would think that's just fine, because I still think that we judge women much more harshly than we judge men. But yeah, she was great fun to write.
You know, that's a really interesting perception. I had never thought about that, but that's true, that even on the page, as we imagine them, when we're both the casting director and the director and the cinematographer of the movie we're making in our heads, we're still using the same morality that we inherited from Hollywood. So I guess what that tells us is that Hollywood is as powerful as we feared, because it changes the way we see things.
Yes. Yeah, I truly think the Hollywood affects the way we see things. And so you see, I mean, you know, things like Mary Tyler Moore, you know, she was the first TV show about a professional woman. And so, you know, she very much shaped how we see professional women, as, you know, you have to be spunky and attractive and get along, but still hold your inner core so that you can do something. So it's, I have so much admiration for some of the earlier actresses who showed us how to be something different than what traditional women were. Women like Katharine Hepburn, I just adore her. You know, Audrey Hepburn, for that matter, and certainly Grace Kelly. I mean, you know, there's a reason that Grace Kelly is very much at the center of this story, because I just adore Grace Kelly, you know. And there's a reason Rear Window is at the center of this, because I just adore, you know, Rear Window. And that's a role where Grace Kelly is both gets along and has things that she wants, that she is not afraid to go for. And I really admire, you know, she is who she is, and she's not going to be anybody else. So I admire that about her.
As Lou Grant once said, "You've got spunk. I hate spunk."
That's great. That's great. Yeah,
that's fun. You know,
one of the things that's interesting is one of the spunky characters, women characters in the novel, is Alma Hitchcock, and people don't necessarily know a lot about. They know a lot about Alfred Hitchcock, and they don't know about Alma. And one of the things they don't know is that when Hitchcock first met Alma, he was too afraid to speak to her or anything, because she was senior to him. She had been in film longer, in British film, and the role she was in behind the scenes was senior to where he was. And so it was not until he got a role that was senior to her that he said hello to her, basically. But he's famous for saying, you know, there are three women, there are three people who are really important in my life, and one is a great writer, and one is a great mother, and one is the great, the finest cook I've ever met, and they're all named Alma Reville, which was his wife's name. So she was very fun to bring to the page. It was harder to find out about her than about Hitchcock, and so most of what I know about her is reflected through books about Hitchcock and stories about Hitchcock, but she was a very fun character to write as well.
You know, and if I were to sum this book up The word I would use is, I think, charming. And and it's truly charming in a way that we like everybody pretty much, even Mannix at the end. I kind of like him, even though he's maybe because he's kind of an SOE. But that aside, I think so. Talk about writing a book that's charming in an age when charming is, not always an ass, or not always the ass that it should be, but in a book description, you want it, terrorizing and thrilling, scary.
Yeah. You know, I guess
fun.
I'm kind of old fashioned, but I love charm. I think, I will tell you that my husband is one of the most charming people I've ever met, and I totally am a sucker for his charm, So I think charm is perhaps underrated. And I think part of that's because it's not always done well. I mean, you take the romantic comedy, for example, when you look at the romantic comedies of Nora Ephron, they all have at their heart something that's just a really charming story. And we have walked away from that a little bit in a way that I think makes a lot of people longing for the next Nora Ephron, because we like that. I think there's a real joy in being in a comfortable space that makes us feel good, even as it carries us along in the story. And if that's what I've created, then that would make me very happy.
Now, my question is, are you returning to that book that was cast aside before this one?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. Sometimes I think yes, and sometimes I think no. I always have a few balls up in the air, a few things I'm working on, a few things I'm pushing forward. That is certainly a novel that is a very. It's based on a true story. It's set in World War II Paris. Gives me an excuse to go to Paris again. It's never. I never like to turn down. And it's a. At its heart, a book about books and the power of books. So I think it would be very interesting to write. It is certainly darker than Typewriter Beach, I think, which is at its core, three love stories, I think. So I might do that next. I have an idea for a novel set in London, that's a little bit later. Might do that next. We'll see. The thing is, the one that I set aside to do this one, I could finish writing that in probably 3 months, and probably I should. Well, I've got all the research done. I've got I've got probably 100 pages of it. It shouldn't be that hard to write. So maybe I'll do that next. I don't know. You have to go where your heart is taking you. So we'll see where, and my heart is not quite sure yet. It's it's a little bipolar right now. It's not sure whether it wants to go dark or light,
Well, one of the great joys of this book is that our hearts go with yours as we read the novel. The new novel by Meg Waite Clayton is Typewriter Beach. Thank you for joining me, Meg.
Thank you so much, Rick. This has been absolutely lovely.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.